This podcast discusses crimes against children and may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Be sure to head over to thecrimeshack.com for all available episodes, merchandise, and show notes, and subscribe to us for free wherever you get your podcasts. As you know, it takes a lot of research and time to keep this podcast going. You can help the show by purchasing merchandise, joining my Patreon, or just by buying me a coffee. My podcast is currently sponsorless, and any support from my listeners is much appreciated. Camping. We've all done it, right? Now, maybe you've never camped a day in your life, and the notion of sleeping in a tent surrounded by the elements, getting dirty, possibly not having access to a shower, is not your idea of a good time. I personally love to camp and love nature and have many fond memories of summer camp as a child. I think many of us can say that we've done something similar in our lifetimes. One thing I did not get involved in as a child was being a Girl Scout. I know many of you listening have experienced being a part of that organization or of the Boy Scouts and can attest to the many outings that they would take to impart different skill sets and outdoor experiences to its members. But this episode of the Crime Shack isn't about the virtues and skills that the Scouts can instill in you. No, this episode that I'm going to be sharing involves a Girl Scout camping trip that went horribly wrong. This case is a chilling tale that will touch on our innate fears of being secluded in a wooded forest at night and hearing eerie sounds around you, not knowing if it's an animal scurrying about or something much, much worse. So turn off your lights and grab your flashlights because we'll be heading deep into the Ozark Mountains of Oklahoma. It was a beautiful, sunny, warm day that Sunday, June 12, 1977. Camp Scott in Locust Grove, Oklahoma, a small community with a population of about 1,000 people, was preparing for the arrival of more than 130 campers that afternoon. It was the opening day of Camp Scott, and campers, their parents, and counselors were arriving at the Girl Scout headquarters in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to meet the buses that would transport them to Camp Scott. Camp Scott first opened on August 11, 1928 as Camp Ma Del Co and was owned by the Tulsa Scout Council. The camp sits on a total of 410 acres of land and lies in an unincorporated area of Mays County within the Ozark Mountains of Oklahoma. The camp is located just west of Main Highway 82 and is situated about 0.9 miles off a private dirt road on a secluded, heavily wooded property. A few years after the camp opened, the name was changed to Camp Scott, and by 1977, it was being run by the Magic Empire Council of Girl Scouts, one of 331 councils chartered by the Girl Scouts of USA. Activities such as swimming, archery, and leadership skills were included at the camp. A main thoroughfare, Cookie Trail Road, which was a dirt road, ran through the campground and was surrounded by small creeks on the east, west, and south. The nearest incorporated town of Locust Grove was just a little over 3 miles away. The camp was set up with 11 subcamps, each with Native American tribal names, and there were 7 main buildings within the camp: the director's office, the Great Hall, a health center, a ranger's house, staff house, a cook's cabin, a red barn, and a swimming pool. Each subcamp had about 7 to 8 large canvas tents set up on wooden platforms that could house about 4 individuals per tent, and the tents were set around stone encircled campfires. The canvases that covered each tent had a slit down the front for the entrance, with the back closed in, and a wood plank floor. The counselors had their own separate tents at each subcamp, and the remaining staff members stayed in the staff house. The platform tents were not evenly spaced within each subcamp, and the subcamps were not placed equally along the Cookie Trail. Some were further apart than the next. The Kiowa subcamp sat furthest west and was more isolated from the Cookie Trail than the other subcamps. Back at Girl Scout headquarters in Tulsa, 9-year-old Michelle Gousset was excited about this year's trip to Camp Scott. Michelle had been to the camp the year prior, and now a veteran camper, was looking forward to the upcoming 2 weeks. Michelle was an athletic girl who enjoyed playing sports and was a member of a local soccer team. She had a younger brother named Michael and had an intense fascination for gardening. With her short brunette hair tucked under a white sun hat, she instructed her parents before boarding the bus that day to please water the African violets. Her parents, Dick and Georgianne Gousset, assured her that they would. Lori Lee Farmer would be the youngest girl at Camp Scott that year. Lori was the oldest of 5 children in the Farmer family. A pretty girl with long blonde hair, she was mature for her age, and at 8 years old, she had just completed the 4th grade and was doing so well in school that she'd been able to advance a grade. Lori had been torn between attending Camp Scott that year or going to a camp sponsored by the Tulsa area YMCA. It was a tough decision to make, so Lori asked her mother Sherry to decide for her. Sherry chose Camp Scott, a decision that she would come to regret for the rest of her life. Lori would be celebrating her 9th birthday just 5 days into her first week at Camp Scott, and her parents had promised to come up to camp to celebrate it with her. 10-year-old Doris Denise Milner, who was called by her middle name Denise, was a straight-A award-winning student who had just been accepted into the prestigious Carver Middle School, a magnet blue ribbon school in Tulsa. As she awaited the arrival of the buses, Denise was experiencing the first camp jitters. Denise struggled with the thought of having to leave her mother and her 5-year-old sister. This would be Denise's first Girl Scout camping trip, and she was a bit nervous about going. She told her mother Betty that she wasn't sure she wanted to go, but Betty convinced her that she should try it, that it would make her more independent, and if she didn't like it, she could always call her and she'd come to pick her up. The buses had finally arrived, and everyone gathered around them to begin to board. 15-year-old Michelle Hoffman was another veteran camper, having attended Camp Scott during the last 6 years. Michelle would recall her first experience attending Camp Scott. My first year at Camp Scott, I remember going, whoa, because it was so dark, dark, dark in those woods at night. If you've never been camping in a platform tent deep in the woods, it's a little intimidating. After your first time there, you get it. You're just prepared. It's going to be dark. Her 7th year at the camp, however, would be much different, as Michelle was now too old to be a camper, and she was selected to be an aide to the camp director. As the parking lot swarmed with campers, Michelle spotted shy Denise Milner and made her way over to the girl. Michelle recognized that Denise was one of the only African-American girls in the group and wanted to make sure she felt encouraged about the trip. Michelle approached Denise and her mother and introduced herself. Betty explained to Michelle that Denise was feeling a bit nervous and homesick, and Michelle reassured them both that everything was going to be great and that Denise could ride up in the front of the bus with her. As they got on the bus and took their seats towards the front, Betty hopped on quickly to say goodbye and to ask Michelle if she could call her if Denise was still homesick the next day. The buses quickly piled up with excited campers and staff, and they departed for Camp Scott. Camp songs filled the 45-minute drive, but Denise remained fairly quiet for the trip, preferring to stare out the bus window as the scenery changed from busy city streets to rugged, thick forests. When they arrived at Camp Scott, the campers and staff rushed out of the buses and were provided instructions to their assigned tents. Those campers who'd attended Camp Scott before and were familiar with the camp setup quickly ran to their designated tents. Michelle Hoffman, who had stayed with Denise, personally brought Denise to her assigned campground, Kiowa. She was told that she was assigned to tent number 8, along with two other girls. The tents in Kiowa subcamp were oriented in a semicircle, and tent number 8 was the furthest tent from the others, as well as the furthest from the counselor's tent. The view from the counselor's tent to tent number 8 was also partially obstructed by the camp's shower building. Counselors Carla Wilhite and Susan Emery, both 18 years old, and 20-year-old Dee Elder were assigned to Kiowa Camp and had the task of looking after 27 campers. Lori Farmer and Michelle Gousset would also be joining Denise Milner in tent number 8. Denise's nervousness faded when she met Lori and Michelle, and they quickly became friends. Counselor Carla Wilhite would later recall that the girls in tent number 8 were three of the quietest kids, but that the tent was just as loud and lively as the others. Carla had also recalled some strange incidents that happened about 2 months prior to the beginning of Camp Scott in April 1977. The camp held an on-site orientation training session where camp counselors were required to attend. Counselor Michelle Hoffman had discovered that her and her roommate's tent had been ransacked by someone, and donuts that she'd left on the table next to her bed were missing. Inside of the empty donut box were a few pieces of tiny steno notebook paper. On the paper was handwritten in all capital letters, "We are on a mission to kill three girls in Tent 1. It was signed by the killer and had an effigy of a man hanging from a tree by his neck. Frightened by the letter, Michelle showed the director the note, but the director dismissed it as a prank and threw the note away. In another incident during orientation, Carla had hurt her back lifting sailboats and slept for a bit after being given Tylenol and codeine. When she woke, she headed down to Cedar Lodge, a tent near the Red Barn on the east side of Cookie Trail Road, where a campout was being held. Carla had intended to go sleep in the staff house after she ate because she couldn't sleep on the floor in one of the tents and she didn't want to be at the infirmary by herself. That night when she was asleep in the staff house, Carla heard a strange scratching noise behind the staff house on the screen of the enclosed patio. It sounded as if someone's body had rubbed up against the screen. Carla assumed it was a camper playing a prank, and she yelled out, "Who's there?" but got no response and heard footsteps walking away. She laid back down and listened for a while she heard more footsteps. She then got up and looked out the front window, thinking it was maybe the camp's dog, Sally. When she looked out the window, she could see Sally running from across the way from the ranger's house. Sally was barking and growling at something. Carla looked around but didn't see what Sally had been barking at, but it scared her enough that she grabbed her blanket and ran across to another building where she knew another counselor was and had them come and sit with her until she fell back asleep. Also during the orientation, one of the tent canvases sustained a 6-inch tear in it. A counselor thought it may have been caused by the weather, but wasn't sure. It was around 6 p.m. on the first night of camp, and the campers were finishing up dinner and heading back to their tents when a thunderstorm rolled into the campground and it began to pour. The girls quickly ran to their assigned tents and spent the rest of the evening chatting, laughing, and writing letters to their parents before heading off to sleep. Lori Farmer wrote a note to her family. "Dear Mom and Dad and Misty and Joe and Chad and Kathy, we're just getting ready to go to bed. It's 7:45. We're at the beginning of a storm and having a lot of fun. I've met two new friends, Michelle Gousset and Denise Milner. I'm sharing a tent with them. It started raining on the way back from dinner. We're sleeping on cots. I couldn't wait to write. We're all writing letters now because there's hardly anything else to do. With love, Lori." Denise, who was still suffering from a bout of homesickness, also took out some stationery and wrote,
"Dear Mom, I don't like camp. It's awful.
The first day it rained, I have three new friends named Linda, Lori, and Michelle. Michelle and Lori are my roommates. Mom, I don't want to stay at camp for 2 weeks. I want to come home and see Cassie and everybody.
Your loving child, Denise Milner."
It was between the hours of 8 and 10 p.m. when a counselor who was staying in the Comanche subcamp, the camp next to and just south of Kiowa camp, saw a dim amber light moving through the woods heading towards Kiowa camp. She didn't think too much of it and ignored it, as campers would often get up to go to the bathrooms in the middle of the night. At 10 p.m., Counselor D. Elder of Kiowa camp walked around to do her tent check for the night. Everyone was in their respective tents, and everything seemed to be in order. At around midnight, Counselor Carla Wilhite heard the girls from the tents giggling and making noise around the bathrooms. She got up, went to talk to the girls and to escort them back to their beds, then headed back to her own tent. At 1:30 a.m., Carla is again woken up by giggling coming from tent number 6. She points her flashlight at the tent and yells over at the girls to quiet down. Carla tells D. Elder they should get up and go check on them. On their way over to the tent, both of them hear a low guttural sound coming from the woods behind the tents. Carla shone a light on the woods and the sound stopped. She assumed it was an animal and the two headed back to their tent to try to get some sleep. During the documentary, Someone Cried for the Children, which was aired in 1994, Carla relayed what she had heard that night.
"I woke up and I heard a noise coming from an area kind of off the road by our tent. It was kind of intermittent. It wasn't continuous. Something like a cross between a frog and a bullhorn or something. It was low and kind of guttural. It wasn't language. It didn't really seem human. It didn't sound like any animal I'd ever heard."
It was around the same time that Carla and Dee heard the guttural sounds that other people in the campground had reported hearing moaning sounds coming from the direction of tent number 8. About 30 minutes later, a camp in tent number 7 in Kiowa camp was woken up when a figure with a flashlight opened the entrance flap to their tent and shined a light in the tent. The person quickly closed the flap and left. At around 3 a.m., a camper heard a single scream coming from the area of tent number 8. Around the same time, another camper heard someone crying out, "Mama! Mama!" After that strange first night, Carla Wilhite's alarm went off just before dawn around 6 a.m. the next morning. She scuffled out of her tent and headed to the staff house to shower so she could take advantage of the warm water before all the girls woke up. She headed towards Cookie Trail and up towards the direction of the Quapaw subcamp, which was next to the staff house. As Carla walked up Cookie Trail, she spotted something up ahead at the fork of the trail, just south of Quapaw subcamp and off to the side of the road. As she got closer, she saw what looked like some sort of bags. She figured that someone must have dropped off some stray luggage that hadn't made it to the campsites. She continued walking closer to the bags when she suddenly stopped and realized in horror that what she thought was luggage was actually a sleeping bag. And on top of the sleeping bag lay the body of a young girl. The girl was lying face up, she was naked from the waist down, and she wasn't moving. Carla thought an accident had happened and ran back to the counselor tent to wake up counselors Dee and Susan and to notify the staff of the discovery. The counselors then quickly checked in the other tents. When Dee checked tent number 8, she realized that all 3 girls were missing from the tent. Carla ran to get the camp nurse and to locate the camp director, Barbara Day. When Carla brought both women back to the scene, the nurse immediately checked the girl for vitals, but it was clear that the girl, who was later identified as 10-year-old Denise Milner, was dead. There were injuries to Denise's head, and her hands were tied behind her back. Barbara's husband, Richard Day, was the next to arrive on the scene. Richard would soon discover that what lay before them was much worse than they thought. He noticed that there were 2 other sleeping bags lying near Denise's body. When he went to pick up the bags, they were heavy. It was obvious there was something inside of them, and they all knew that 3 girls from Kiowa Camp were missing. He knelt down and felt on top of the bags and could feel that there was a body in each bag. Richard did not open the bags, but told Barbara to contact police. Barbara Day called an emergency number she had programmed in her phone and told them she needed 3 ambulances as there were 3 dead children. Officer Harold Berry was the first officer to the scene at around 7:30 a.m. By 8 a.m., Sheriff Glenn Pete Weaver was on the scene and requested the help from the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, or OSBI. Michael Wilkerson, the lead agent for OSBI, had recalled what they found when they arrived at the crime scene.
We walked over and there were 2 bags. I know the first thing I was struck by is how tiny, tiny, tiny the figures were in the sleeping bags. They took up only 1 small portion of the sleeping bag. And laying near the sleeping bag was a little black girl about probably 10 years old. And somebody had covered her with one of the sleeping bags. We opened the first sleeping bag and there was a tiny little blonde-headed girl laying in the sleeping bag. And I remember Carrie, as he snapped the picture as we opened the sleeping bag, all he could say is, "My God, my God." And then we checked the 3rd bag, which contained another little small girl, darker-headed, who was bound with her hands behind her back. And, of course, she was dead, too.
The 2 other girls found inside of the sleeping bags were identified as 8-year-old Lori Farmer and 9-year-old Michelle Gousset. Both girls had been bludgeoned to death, and Michelle's hands had been bound behind her back. In investigating the scene, OSBI noticed 1 set of boot prints leading from Kiowa Camp to the spot where the bodies were found. From the evidence, it appeared that the perpetrator had approached the rear of tent number 8 and unhooked the back flaps to get inside. Judging by the blood that was spattered on the insides of the canvas walls and on the wood floor, authorities believe that Lori and Michelle were both bludgeoned inside of the tent. Someone had tried to wipe up the blood with mattress covers and towels, which were found in the sleeping bags with the girls. A size 10 boot print and a size 7 either shoe or tennis shoe print was found both inside and outside the tent. A 9.5 size shoe print was found stamped in the blood on the inside of the tent. Denise had also been bound with her hands behind her back, and her mouth had been stuffed with a gag before authorities believed she was either dragged or carried to the area where the other 2 girls' bodies were found. There was evidence at the scene that the attacks had been planned. The gag on Denise was pre-sewn, and the killer had brought nylon rope and duct tape to bind the girls. A large red flashlight was found next to the bodies. The bodies were found about 150 feet from tent number 8 of Kiowa Camp. Before even contacting the parents of the 3 girls to tell them that their daughters had been murdered, the executive director with Magic Empire Council contacted their insurance company, Then they contacted their attorney. Once they had those two phone calls out of the way, they then contacted the parents. In the phone calls to the parents of Lori, Michelle, and Denise, the executive director did not, however, tell them that the girls had been murdered, only that there had been an accident and that they had died. The parents eventually learned what had actually happened to their daughters by seeing the coverage on the news stations. Dick and Georgianne Gousset talk about the moment that authorities called them to tell them about the death of their daughter, Michelle.
They knocked on the door and they said that they had something to tell me about Michelle. And I said, is there a problem? And they said, we need to come in. And they introduced themselves, you know. And I said, is she hurt? And they said, well, come in and sit down. And then it was at that point, they said that there had been an accident at camp. And they never did tell me that she had been murdered.
We finally turned the TV on. That's how we learned how she died.
And here's Charles and Sherry Farmer talking about when they were first notified of Lori's death.
And I received a call from the executive director of the Girl Scout organization. She told me that Lori and two other girls were found dead out some distance behind their tent. No explanation, nothing else. Not that there was any violence involved.
Imagine being the parents of these three children when they found out that they hadn't even been the first ones to be contacted about what had happened. That the Girl Scouts were more concerned with covering themselves both legally and financially than notifying the parents that their daughters had been murdered. As additional investigators began to arrive at the scene that day, security was increased at all the other subcamps at Camp Scott. The campground was evacuated of all campers and staff at around 10 a.m., with buses transporting confused campers back to their families in Tulsa. The campers weren't told what had happened to cause their sudden departure from the campground after having only stayed one night at the camp. In the weeks following the murders, a private security company was hired to guard the camp, which was now vacant. According to the guards, there was evidence that someone was still stalking the camp. They'd find footprints in fresh sand, and doors were opened that they had previously shut. They also talked about seeing silhouettes in the dense woods on multiple occasions. To see if anyone was out there, the guards started to leave threads tied to trees between certain pathways. They would find the threads broken upon later inspection. During another day, the guards went to the Great Hall, which they would use as an office. At the door of the hall, they discovered a bag that contained pink socks and a pair of tennis shoes with the name Denise Milner written inside. Both the socks and the shoes were wet. OSBI examined the socks and shoes, but said that two pairs of shoes were already in evidence, and they believed that the ones found by the guards were separate evidence entirely, but the shoes were never linked to anything. It didn't take long before reports of what happened at Camp Scott quickly hit the news stations, and by 8 a.m. there were already stories about a freak accident or foul play. When Sid Wise, the Mays County District Attorney who was assigned to the case, was asked by a news reporter what kind of person could have done something like that, this is what he had to say.
We obviously know that it's a person who doesn't belong to what we accept as the normal human race.
On June 14th, the wooden floor of tent number 8 was removed and airlifted to a crime lab. Against the investigators' wishes and to the frustration of Sid Wise, the media published that a tennis shoe print was found outside the tent and that a different print was found inside the tent. The next day on June 15th, about 7 miles from the camp, a man who was living out of his car was briefly arrested, questioned, and released. The large red flashlight that was found next to the sleeping bags was tested, and a partial fingerprint was found on the lens, but it couldn't be identified. When police questioned the camp counselors and staff about what had happened that night, many recalled the noises that they had heard, the amber light seen from Quapaw Camp, and the scream they had heard in the middle of the night. Witnesses that lived around the area of Camp Scott were questioned, and one landowner claimed that between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. on the early morning of June 13th, they heard quite a bit of traffic on a remote road near the campground. Investigators headed to a ranch about a mile west of the camp that was owned by farmer Jack Schroff. Jack had claimed to have sash cord, a roll of duct tape, 3 bottles of beer, and 3 identical crowbars stolen from his cabin, which may have been used during the execution of the crime. The empty beer bottles were later found on the campgrounds. A shoe print was also found outside of Jack's door. It was a jungle boot style print that matched other boot prints found near the crime scene. After being questioned by authorities, Jack had a solid alibi. He voluntarily took a lie detector test and passed. Jack Schroff was quickly eliminated as a suspect, as well as camp director Richard Day and camp ranger Ben Woodward. On June 16th, tracking dogs arrived from Pennsylvania and began to scour the crime scene and the campground. The press would start to refer to the dogs as wonder dogs. The dogs did not have an easy task ahead of them. The woods were so dense that the dogs often went to an open area or field, sniffed around and followed a scent, but then would look straight up as if the perpetrator vanished into thin air. What could be determined based on the dogs' scent trails was that the perpetrator must have had to pass by the counselor's tent in order to get to tent number 8. The dogs were able to locate eyeglasses and a case belonging to one of the counselors. Officials decided to finally inform the press that they had additional evidence. In addition to the shoe prints and the flashlight that had been covered with a piece of plastic, pieces of cord, a roll of black duct tape, and a pair of women's glasses with an eyeglass case were all obtained as evidence. The eyeglasses and case were discovered to belong to a camper in the Kiowa unit and to one of the counselors. Autopsies were conducted on the 3 girls by medical examiner Neil A. Hoffman. When Denise was found, she was nude from the waist down, and her pajama top had been pulled up underneath her arms. Her arms were tied with duct tape behind her back. The other 2 girls were found tucked inside the zipped sleeping bags, each in a fetal-like position. All 3 girls were struck with a blunt instrument to the head. Lori and Michelle, who it was believed were attacked while inside of the tent, were struck on the back of their heads while they slept. The weapon or weapons that were used were held in both the right and left hands of the perpetrator. It was also evident that more than one weapon was used to bludgeon the 3 girls. Denise Milner's face had been struck so viciously and with such force that the weapon used had left behind its shape. A cord and an elastic bandage were around her neck, and a round cylinder-shaped object about 4 inches long, made of terry cloth, was attached to the cord. The elastic bandage had been used to blindfold her, and the terry cloth had been used to gag her. Denise had also been sexually assaulted, strangled, and was believed to have died on the trail. Her cause of death was strangulation. 2 different types of knots had been used to tie up the girls. It was discovered that 2 of the girls had been raped and the 3rd sodomized. It wasn't made clear which girl suffered which injury. It's important to note, however, that there are conflicting reports as to whether or not the girls were sexually assaulted. Excessive force had been used on all the girls. The murders were certainly overkill. It was believed that the girls were killed sometime between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. No fingerprints other than the partially unidentifiable print on the flashlight were found. Semen was found on each of the girls' bodies as well as on the red flashlight. A single hair that was attached to a piece of duct tape was confirmed to not belong to any of the girls. If you're thinking, what about DNA evidence? DNA wasn't used as a material to identify an individual until the 1980s and was first used to solve two murders in 1983 and 1986. So unfortunately, it wasn't being used at the time of these murders. I'll be talking more about the DNA testing later on in this episode. Both the evidence found at the scene as well as the autopsies indicated that there was possibly more than one offender involved. The perpetrators brought the items used at the crime scene with them, so they were well prepared. But they didn't take any precautions to conceal the bodies, and the crime scene was disorganized and sloppy, and the wiping down of the blood inside of the tent was haphazard. Investigators believed that the crimes were well planned out, possibly months in advance, and that the killers, if there was more than one, knew each other well and knew the area well to be able to navigate the scene with ease. They also believed that only one of the girls was targeted and that the other two were murdered so as to not identify the attacker. The viciousness of the murders indicated to investigators that the offenders may have killed before or had been involved in some type of violent crime. On June 18th, Sheriff Glenn Weaver, who was spearheading the investigation, claimed to have found the murder weapon, a crowbar. However, the district attorney, Sid Wise, denied any weapon had been found. A search of the area utilizing the tracking dogs uncovered a cave about 3 miles southwest from Camp Scott. Inside of the cave, there was a flashlight battery, a pair of red lace panties, a pair of sunglasses and a vinyl case that were seemingly stolen from a Camp Scott counselor, a roll of tape, and plastic material that matched the plastic used to cover the flashlight lens, and pictures of two women, possibly in a wedding. There were also pages of a Tulsa newspaper that matched up with the same edition of the newspaper that investigators found stuffed inside the flashlight found near the girls' bodies. The paper had been used to wedge the batteries in the flashlight to restore a loose connection. These pieces of evidence could possibly have had something to do with the murders, but investigators needed something more solid. They put the pictures of the women on television and in newspapers to see if anyone recognized them. A prison officer who had a part-time job as a wedding photographer happened to recognize the women in the photos. They were from a wedding that he'd photographed. As part of a photography course in prison, a prisoner named Jean Leroy Hart had helped to develop the photos. The cave that had the items and the pictures was only a few hundred feet from a cellar and foundation, remnants, coincidentally, of Jean Hart's childhood home. Strangely, there was another cave nearby where on the wall of the cave was written, "The killer was here. Bye-bye, fools. 77-6-17. The unusual date format was said to be used by the military and the prison system. There were a couple of individuals who were targeted as possible suspects, but authorities had their focus on one individual, 34-year-old Jean Leroy Hart. Hart, born in 1943 and of Cherokee descent, had been raised about a mile from Camp Scott and was a local football hero. In 1966, Hart had kidnapped two pregnant women outside a nightclub, put them in the trunk of his car, drove them to a forest on the outskirts of Locust Grove, and raped them. The women that he had raped had been gagged and bound with duct tape and rope. He then put duct tape over their noses and mouths and left them to die in the woods. The women managed to untie themselves and ran for help. They offered authorities the make and model of Hart's vehicle, as well as provided them with a physical description of Hart. When asked to describe how Hart was during the rape, the women said he was incoherent and that he made strange growling noises. Hart was eventually captured and had committed three burglaries while he was an escapee, In each case, the victims were asleep in their houses at the time. Hart did eventually admit to the rape of the two women and the burglaries and was sentenced to 305 years. However, Hart had escaped Mays County Jail in Pryor, Oklahoma in 1973 and had been at large ever since. The fact that Hart was able to escape Mays County Jail and evade Sheriff Weaver for so many years led many locals to believe that the sheriff had a personal vendetta that drove the manhunt for Hart for the Girl Scouts' murders. Members of the American Indian Movement had argued that Sheriff Weaver was trying to find a scapegoat among their tribe to pin the murders on. Investigators had believed that the local Cherokee community had been helping Hart hide out since his escape. The FBI became involved in searching for Hart and launched what was to be the largest and longest manhunt in Oklahoma history. They enlisted 40 FBI agents to search for Hart, as well as 600 volunteers to be involved in the search. Hart was eventually tracked down 10 months after the murders. Agent Larry Bowles was working with an informant within the Cherokee community when he found out that Hart had been hiding out at the home of a Cherokee man named Sam Pigeon, about 50 miles from Camp Scott. Pigeon was convinced of Hart's innocence and had let him live in his three-bedroom shack for the last 8 months. Agent Bowles and OSBI officers surrounded the shack, and on April 6, 1978, Hart was arrested and charged with three first-degree murders. A child's mirror and a small corncob pipe were taken as evidence from the shack. While Bowles was taking Hart into custody, he asked him a question.
I asked him, I said, you killed those little girls, didn't you? He said, you'll never pin it on me.
Hart quickly enlisted the help of Garvin A. Isaacs and Gary Pitchlin, both Oklahoma City attorneys. Hart's trial began on March 19, 1979, with Judge William Whistler presiding and S.M. Buddy Fallis representing the state. On March 20th, a day after the trial began, Gene Hart held a press conference where he answered pre-selected questions from the press.
I am not a hero. I have no desire to be a hero. But maybe I represent the fears and doubts that many people have about any system that has the means and the power to overwhelm each of us, each and every one of us.
The trial lasted 11 days, ending on March 30th, 1979. The jury was comprised of six men and six women, and they included a school teacher, a plant manager, a gas firm foreman, and a housewife. None of the jurors were from Locust Grove, and all of them were sequestered for the entirety of the trial. Many people in the community rallied behind Hart, a former high school football star, including members of the Native American population who felt Hart was being targeted because of his ethnicity. Many believed that the OSBI had planted evidence to convict him, and it was also leaked to the media that sperm had been found in the semen that was obtained for evidence, but Hart was known to have had a vasectomy. The evidence presented by the prosecution seemed to rest on two key pieces of evidence: a piece of hair found at the crime scene, and semen found on the bodies. Dr. John McLeod, America's foremost authority on male fertility at the time, testified that Hart's sperm was quite similar to the sperm taken from the victims' bodies. It also came out in testimony during the trial that apparently Hart's vasectomy hadn't been successful. The prosecution presented evidence that the newspaper found in the cave was a match to the newspaper found in the flashlight at the crime scene. They claimed that the hair that was found on the duct tape at the crime scene matched Hart's hair, that it had come from either Hart or someone with the same microscopic characteristics. It's interesting to note that as of 2015, microscopic hair analysis had been discredited as a forensic technique due to the many problems in analyzing it. The prosecution also presented evidence of the mirror and the corncob pipe found at the shack where Hart was captured and identified those as belonging to a camper who was at Camp Scott the night of the murders. The items that the state claimed linked Hart to the crime scene were the pair of glasses and its case that had been stolen from the camp counselor's tent the night of the murders and were found near the bodies, the duct tape that was found in the cave that also matched the tape found at the scene, and the photos of the women that linked to Hart's time in prison. The defense claimed that the glasses had been taken from Hart's prior rape victims, and Hart had admitted this as well, and that Sheriff Weaver had planted the rest of the evidence at the crime scene. They also stated that the 9.5 bloody footprint in the tent could not have been a match for Hart's foot, as he wore a size 11 shoe. They stated that the fingerprint on the flashlight was not a match to Hart, that the swabs taken from the girls were inconclusive, and that the hair on the duct tape was similar to Hart's, but it could not be proven that it belonged to Hart. Gene Hart did not take the stand in his own defense. Waitress Dean Boyd was called to testify and stated that she'd seen a nervous man, which was not Hart, at her diner the morning of the murders. Her diner was approximately 15 miles from Camp Scott. The man was identified as William Stevens, a convicted rapist. An 11-year-old camper had also seen Stevens on the Camp Scott grounds in the days just prior to the murders. Stevens' friend Dwayne Peters also testified that he had loaned Stevens the flashlight that was found at the crime scene, and then in October of 1977, Stevens had admitted to him that he killed the girls. Although the local sheriff had said he was 1,000% sure that Gene Hart was guilty, the jury took 6 hours to come to a verdict.
Said the verdict was in. Of course, I asked, I can't remember who I asked because they ran by, and they said he's not guilty.
And it just took a second for them to read it.
Total hush over the courtroom as the verdict was announced.
We heard a noise when we heard the verdict. Because of their jubilation, we looked over there and they were celebrating.
And then it was pandemonium in the courtroom. People were hugging Hart's lawyers. They were hugging Gene Hart. I saw people with the media hugging Gene Hart and Gene Hart's family. Yelling and laughing in there. It was mass hysteria on that side of the courtroom.
The jury acquitted Gene Hart of all charges on March 31st, 1979. However, having a prior conviction from 1976 for raping the two women, Hart still had that 305-year sentence left to serve. After only being back in prison for a little over a month, Hart was working out with weights and jogging in the Oklahoma State Penitentiary prison yard when he collapsed and died of a heart attack on June 4th, 1979. Hart was 35 years old. In an attempt to hold someone responsible for the girls' safety, in 1985, Charles and Sherry Farmer and Betty and Walter Milner sued the Magic Empire Council of Girl Scouts and its insurer for $5 million, alleging negligence. The civil trial that ensued included discussion of the threatening handwritten note that was found by the camp counselor during orientation, as well as the fact that tent number 8 was 258 feet from the counselor's tent. The families, however, lost the suit by a 9-3 vote, as jurors decided in favor of Magic Empire. Magic Empire Council then sold the property and the remnants of the camp buildings in 1988. Also in 1985, Sherry Farmer opened a Parents of Murdered Children chapter in Oklahoma, an organization dedicated to providing assistance and support to the families of homicide victims. The organization is still functioning today, however, they no longer have a chapter in the state of Oklahoma. Dick Gousset, Michelle's father, helped establish the Victims Bill of Rights in Oklahoma, as well as the Oklahoma Victims Compensation Board. Dick Gousset said that throughout the investigation of the murder of the three girls, he and his wife Georgianne were ignored by law enforcement and prosecutors, so he drafted the bill to create coordinating centers in Oklahoma to keep victims and families involved in each step of the legal process. The Compensation Board helps to provide victims and their family members with money to assist them with various expenses. Over the years, many people have contacted law enforcement to point to a potential suspect, but all leads have been fruitless. Many believe the case to have been solved with the arrest, albeit acquittal, of Jean Leroy Hart. 12 years after the murders in 1989, DNA testing was conducted on semen samples that were found on a pillowcase from the crime scene. The test showed 3 of the 5 probes matched bodily fluids taken from Jean Hart. Statistically, DNA from 1 in 7,700 Native Americans would obtain these results. As only 3 of the 5 probes matched, the results were deemed inconclusive. In December 2001, the DNA was analyzed again. Investigators were able to retrieve a partial DNA profile from a female, but they don't know which female. The information was not sufficient for comparison to the girls and resulted in no conclusive results. 31 years later, in 2008, new DNA testing was conducted on the semen stains, but the samples were too deteriorated to obtain a DNA profile. In 2017, the current Mays County Sheriff's Department had raised over $30,000 in donations in order to do new DNA tests using the latest advances in testing. The report and results of those tests are pending. Lori Farmer's little sister is still hopeful that the mystery of who murdered her sister will be solved. Here's Lori from a 2017 interview with KJRH-TV in Tulsa.
I have faith that there will be some answers and somebody will come forward with something.
Breaking her silence for the first time about the tragedy that shaped her life.
I felt like, you know, I had to step into Lori's shoes and take care of them too.
Caring for her siblings and later being a bit overprotective of her own boys.
At the end of every conversation or phone call, I always say, I love you, you know, because you just never know.
What do you think? Do you believe that this is no longer a cold case and that the murderer was Jean Leroy Hart? Or do you believe the killer or killers got away with murdering 3 young Girl Scouts in the dead of night on that warm June evening? I'd love to say that I'm convinced they had the right guy, that the families of Lori, Denise, and Michelle can be reassured that the real killer was captured. But what if? What if they didn't? And the killer or killers are still walking among us. We may never know the truth or have definitive DNA tests from the crime scene. And that may be something we'll have no choice but to live with. Camp Scott was evacuated following the murders and subsequently shut down. The camp has since remained abandoned and is frequently visited by paranormal enthusiasts and ghost hunters who claim that the property is haunted by the 3 girls. The Girl Scouts sold the camp in the 1980s to a private party, and the land is leased out for hunting only. It's almost unrecognizable and has been overrun with trees and shrubs, but a picnic table, a stone fireplace, and multiple wood tent platforms still remain. Cookie Trail Road, the road that was used to transport the Girl Scouts into Camp Scott, can still be seen through a padlock security gate on the property. Thank you for listening. Please check out our website at thecrimeshack.com, where you can find links to all our social media platforms. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, the only platform where I do giveaways for cool stuff. Did you know I'm also on TikTok, where I do mini crime stories? Check out my profile at Shell's Crime Shack. This podcast is currently sponsorless, and as a listener, you can help support the show by purchasing merchandise, joining my Patreon, or just by buying me a coffee. Any support is much appreciated.